The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
I've traveled around this country from shore to shining shore. It really made me wonder the things I heard and saw. I saw the weary farmer plowing his sod and loam. I heard the auction hammer just a knocking down his home.
But the banks are made of marble with a guard at every door, and the vaults are stuffed with silver that the farmer sweated for.
I saw the weary miner scrubbing coal dust from his back, and I heard his children crying, "We've got no coal to heat the shack."
But the banks are made of marble with a guard at every door, and the vaults are stuffed with silver that the miners sweated for.
I saw the seamen standing idly by the shore, and I heard the owners saying, "Got no work for you no more."
But the banks are made of marble with a guard at every door, and the vaults are stuffed with silver that the seamen sweated for.
Brothers working throughout this mighty land, I prayed we'd get together and together make a stand.
And we own those banks of marble with a guard at every door, and we share those vaults of silver that we have sweated for.
So that prelude, Banks of Marble, was written in 1949 by Les Rice, a New York State apple farmer and president of the Ulster chapter, Ulster County chapter of the Farmers Union. And that particular version we heard was from the Weavers from a 1963 concert in Carnegie Hall. So good morning from Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We're located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. But for those of you on Zoom, thanks to the magic of the internet and our wonderful tech team, we're as close as your home. And thank you for joining us today. We're a Unitarian Universalist congregation dedicated to challenging the mind, nurturing the spirit, and transforming the world. I'm Preston Lutweiler, treasurer of the Board of Trustees. And wherever you are on your life journey, wherever you are on your spiritual journey, whomever you love, whatever your gender identity or expression, whatever work you do, we welcome you into our circle of compassion and caring. The Soul Matters theme for September is living love through the practice of invitation. And on this day before Labor Day, I invite you to reflect with me on two special connections that our small fellowship has to the long struggle for the recognition of the dignity of labor. In many ways, the contribution of Thomas Paine and George MacNeil fit with several of our UU principles, which I understand that we're still allowed to proclaim and display in our lobby. So that's great. So in particular, these of our seven principles, I think, are reflected in the work of Thomas Paine and George MacNeil. Recognizing the worth and dignity of every person, our first principle, promoting justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, experiencing a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, practicing the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process, and advancing the goal of a world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. So now, Linda Weaver will light the chalice while I read words from Reverend Gretchen Haley. This is "We Gather to Draw a Wider Circle." In a world that feeds on moral outrage, we are here to cultivate moral courage. In a time that prizes picking sides, we gather to draw a wider circle. And in a culture that teaches us to get for what we give and to ask, what's in it for me? We come to practice generosity and to remember that we are all in this together. In the midst of life's bitterness, we choose to sing, to give thanks, to laugh together, and to be keepers of beauty, to offer a place of belonging for all who come in gladness and in pain, to resist the push to the next moment and the next, to slow down and breathe more deeply, to feel a part of something greater for this hour and in this space. Let us be the change we wish to see. Come, let us worship together. And as Linda lights the peace lamp, please respond with the words that will appear on the screen. May peace be with us and with all the people of the world. Now, our gathering song today is "Bread and Roses." The lyrics and music are by Lorraine Buspini, based on a poem by James Oppenheimer. This version is performed by Bronwyn Lewis and the cast of the 2014 movie Pride. Now, James Oppenheimer wrote the poem Bread and Roses in support of the women's rights movement. The poem was inspired by a speech by suffragist Helen Todd, who asked for bread for all and roses too. The poem became emblematic of the Lawrence, Massachusetts textile mill strike in 1912, years before women gained the right to vote. Then after the gathering song, and there will be words that appear in the video, so feel free to stand and sing along if you'd like. After the gathering song, Linda will conduct a moment for all ages.
That a sudden sun discloses, for the people here are singing, bread and roses, bread and roses. As we go marching, marching, we battle too for men, for they are women's children, and we from earth.
it so I can actually sit. Will that be okay? Okay. Okay. So we picked a pretty good story. Is that okay, Mike? Okay. And it's called, I'm going to let you look at the slides on the screen, though, okay? It's called They're Heroes Too. And I used to read this to my students because, you know, sometimes it's hard to convey to them, you know, they hear the word hero, and they think it has to be someone who rushed into a burning building and saved someone. But they have to understand that in your daily life, everyone can be a hero. And they could be heroes too in the way they treat others. So, they're heroes too. Most heroes aren't the super kind with capes who fly through air. They're people we see every day who always show they care. The ones who teach us in our schools, that was a shameless plug for me, by the way, who help us cross the street, who care for us when we get sick, who serve good food to eat. The heroes in their great big trucks who take our trash away, the driver on our school bus who greets us every day. Heroes bring our mail to us. They work at cutting hair. They set out food in grocery stores. Heroes everywhere. And when you're brave or generous, we kids are heroes too. You be there for me, and I'll be there for you. And this was a big deal in the beginning of the school year when, you know, some children are new to the area, they don't have friends, and, you know, children need to be shown and taught courtesy and kindness. So point out to them that just by being a friend to someone, you can be their hero. The people we see every day doing what they do, and that's a shameless plug for Manny at the public library. Does everyone see that? Bind our world together. That makes them heroes too. Heroes are people who make the world a better place through their work, generosity, and caring interactions with others. Be a hero. And by the way, I'm looking at a lot of you heroes out there. So thank you for being a hero every day.
Okay, short and sweet, Preston, you're on.
No, we're not singing anything right now.
So now we'll talk about the first of our two local heroes. As a young man, Thomas Paine worked as an excise officer, basically a royal tax collector. And in the town of Lewes, which is south of London, near the coast, he became involved in politics and joined excise officers asking Parliament for better pay and working conditions. And in the summer of 1772, Paine published a 12-page article. It was called The Case of the Officers of Excise. And he spent the winter in London distributing 4,000 copies to Parliament and anybody else that he could find to take it. Nothing came of his article. And in the spring of 1774, he was dismissed from the excise service. To avoid debtor's prison, he sold his household possessions to pay his debts. He separated from his wife and he moved to London, where the commissioner of excise, George Lewis, who must not have disliked him too much if he took him under his wing, and introduced him to Benjamin Franklin, who persuaded him to emigrate to America, where Paine published another pamphlet, Common Sense, a little bit longer than the appeal for the excise officers, in January 1776. That little pamphlet went viral. It became the most popular American publication ever, based on a population of 2.5 million in the colonies at that time. Per capita, more copies were sold than any publication that's ever been sold in America. But because Payne freely gave away the publishing rights to reprint the pamphlet, he never made any money on the pamphlet. He was not a good businessman. Payne's encounters with the indigenous peoples of America influenced his thinking, and he admired their ability to live in harmony with nature, employ democratic decision-making, and treat land as a common good rather than as personal property to be passed down from generation to generation through inheritance. Thomas Paine believed in the inevitability of scientific and social progress. He was committed to free markets and liberty, but he also believed in a society based on the common good. In The Rights of Man, Part Second, that's what he titled it, Paine advocated for state subsidies for poor people, state-financed universal public education, state-sponsored prenatal and postnatal care, including state subsidies to families at childbirth. Pretty radical ideas at that time. Paine thought that a person's labor ought to be over before old age. So he called for a state pension for all workers starting at age 50. And remember, the lifespan back then was not what it is today. So 50 was, you know, an advanced retirement age. Paine's last pamphlet, written after The Rights of Man, went on with those concepts, and it was called Agrarian Justice. It was published in 1795, and it was an essay on how land ownership separated the majority of people from the means for their independent survival. It proposed that government create a national fund paid for by an inheritance tax on landed property as it was passed down from generation to generation. And that fund would be used to pay those who were dispossessed of land a single payment of 15 pounds sterling at the age of 21, as Paine put it, as compensation in part for the loss of his or her natural inheritance by the introduction of the system of landed property. Also, the sum of 10 pounds per annum would be paid to everyone from the age of 50 to their death, his retirement plan. Paine wrote that all accumulation of personal property beyond what a man's own hands produce is derived to him by living in society. He owes on every principle of justice, of gratitude, and of civilization a part of that accumulation back again to society from whence the whole came. So that was Paine's contribution to the thinking of, and eventually became, you know, Social Security and many of our social programs, but it took at least two centuries for much of that to happen. A century later, America, particularly in the North, had evolved from largely an agrarian society to an industrial society. And injustices were arising in the industrial economy. So as a bridge to the next part of our service, we'll listen to a song written and performed by Pete Seeger about the conditions in a mill, which were very much like the conditions that our next UU luminary experienced at a very young age. So this is Hard Times in the Mill, written and performed by Pete Seeger.
Every morning at 4:30, you hear the cooks hop on the floor. It's hard times in the mill, my love, hard times in the mill. Every morning just at 5, gotta get up, dead or alive. It's hard times in the mill, my love, hard times in the mill. Every morning right at 6, don't that old bell make you sick? Hard times in the mill, my love, hard times in the mill. The pulley got hot, the belt jumped off, knocked Mr. Guyon's derby off. It's hard times in the mill, my love, hard times in the mill. When old Pat Goble thinks he's a hun, he puts me in mind of a doodle in the sun. It's hard times in the mill, my love, hard times in the mill. Sexton Han, he thinks he's a man, he ain't got sense to pay off his hands. It's hard times in the mill, my love, hard times in the mill. They steal his ring, they steal his knife, steal everything but his big fat wife. It's hard times in the mill, my love, hard times in the mill. My bobbin's all out, my end's all down, the doffer's in my alley and I can't get around. It's hard times in the mill, my love, hard times in the mill. Section hand standing at the door, ordering the sweepers to sweep up the floor. It's hard times in the mill, my love, hard times in the mill. And every night when I go home, a piece of cornbread and an old jawbone. It's hard times in the mill, my love, hard times in the mill. Ain't it enough to break your heart? I have to work all day and at night it's dark. It's hard times in the mill, my love, hard times in the mill.
So that song pretty well describes the conditions in a typical mill in the late 1800s. And our next UU luminary, George Edwin McNeill, went to work at age 10 in the Amesbury Woolen Company mill. That's a picture of the mill. When he was 15, he was working 14-hour days. Remember the song, get up at 5 o'clock in the morning? Well, he worked in the carding room at the mill, and he worked from 5 in the morning until 7 at night, with 30 minutes for breakfast, 45 minutes for dinner, and the workers brought their dinner in pails or lunch baskets. And it had been customary for the workers to take a 15-minute break as a luncheon privilege at 10 o'clock. On May 31st, 1852, a new manager, John Derby, announced that he was ending the customary morning and afternoon breaks. That was just too much, 15 minutes at 10 o'clock? Are you kidding me? You know, we can't have that. So the next day, 100 workers ignored the new edict and walked out at their appointed luncheon break at 10 o'clock. And when they returned, they were all fired. The next day, the spinners and weavers and other workers in the mill walked out. The workers in the carding room, including 15-year-old George McNeill, went out in strike in sympathy for the other workers. A week after Derby's edict, about 1,000 Amesbury and Salisbury residents publicly voiced their support for the strikers, not for the mill owners. And the Amesbury town meeting approved $2,000 for strike relief and petitioned for legislation to establish a 10-hour workday. The legislation was introduced, but it was never passed. The work action became known as the Derby Strike. The owners of the mill brought in Boston police and hired 50 Irish immigrants to replace the striking workers. And by November, most of the striking workers had found some other employment. The mill was still operating with the Irish immigrants, and the strike ended in November with a whimper. But during the strike, George McNeill had organized his fellow young workers into a mutual benefits society or association, and they paraded in the streets and met for discussion groups in their family homes. Remember, this guy's 15 years old. George prevailed on the local teacher, Master Davis, to guide their discussions, and he ended up graduating from grammar school soon after the strike with the tutelage of Master Davis. And he continued his studies with Master Davis while working in a shoemaker's shop. Eventually, George moved to Boston in 1856, where he worked first as a waiter and then writing for newspapers. He became politically active in the Sons of Temperance. And then in 1863, he co-founded the Grand 8-Hour League, where he served as president for 8 years. He was such an effective speaker, writer, and organizer that the New York Times later called him the father of the 8-hour day. The Massachusetts legislature in 1869 created the first Bureau of Labor Statistics in the United States. There'd never been anything like this to figure out who was employed and what their conditions of employment were and how many people were employed. And George McNeil became the first deputy director. Samuel Gompers later said, while opponents of labor laws were debating its suppression, Mr. McNeil, with the aid of union printers, had the first report of the Bureau published. So he published the first labor statistics report in Massachusetts and the first in the country. Because of his political activities and strong support for labor, George McNeil, like Thomas Paine before him, was fired. He was fired from the Bureau of Labor Statistics in 1873, but not before his work had formed the foundation for an 1874 law that limited the work hours for women and children, not for men, just women and children, to 10 hours a day. The law also required that certain education be given to young kids. But enforcement of the new child labor laws in Massachusetts was pretty weak, and George McNeil was appointed as a constable to enforce labor laws. And in that capacity in 1875, he wrote a pretty scathing report on child labor in Massachusetts. He established a free evening drawing school. He served as an editor of several publications and formed and led several labor organizations. In that era, there were few job safety rules and no state workman's compensation. Insurance, if it was available at all, was expensive and out of the reach of the average worker. And in 1883, George McNeil organized the Massachusetts Mutual Accident Insurance Association, to which members contributed and from which payment would be made to members suffering a loss. Kind of like his mutual society that he formed in the 1852 Derby strike. When the fund got low, an assessment was made to replenish it. Now, George explained his concept of insurance this way. He said, the insurance business in all its branches is more than a commercial enterprise. It is primarily an institution for the relief of humanity in times of distress. It holds its protecting shield over the widow and the orphan. It soothes mental anguish on the bed of pain. It gives courage to those weakened by disaster. It encourages and expresses sympathy. It is Christian in that it cares for the disabled ones. It lessens some of the burdens of life by a system of distribution of loss. So that's pretty far from where AIG and Chubb and the current insurance companies that, you know, run much of the world are today. But that was his vision of what the purpose of insurance should be and how it should be conducted. George McNeil died on May 19th, 1906, at the age of 69. and leaders of the American labor movement, including Samuel Gompers, president of the American Federation of Labor, attended his funeral and eulogized him. George McNeil has a special connection to our fellowship. Some of you know that. Cam Douglas, who I think is on, is on Zoom from Cape Cod, is George McNeil's great-great-grandson. So tomorrow on Labor Day, we should be thankful to Thomas Paine and George McNeil for public education, Social Security, disability insurance, the 8-hour workday, and proud connection that our fellowship has to these accomplishments. So now is going to be time for matters of the heart. We have a brief musical meditation composed and performed by Isaac Strader, after which Mike McNeil will instruct everybody on participating in matters of the heart.
At this time, those who are experiencing a joy that is lifting them up, a sorrow that is weighing them down, or another matter of the heart that they feel compelled to share with this community may do so. There is a microphone at the front of the sanctuary on the left-hand side as we're sitting, where you may go to speak if you're here in the building. And if you've joined us today on Zoom, you may either use Zoom's raise hand function, which you will find under reactions in your Zoom client, or you may type into text and I will read it out for you if you do not feel comfortable speaking today. And with that, the floor is open for anyone who would care to participate.
We'll wrap this up with hymn number 123, Spirit of Life. I believe there will be lyrics on the screen, and we're familiar with this. Feel free to sing along, and then I'll give some closing words. So, Tom Parker, I hope that those hotel workers aren't going to be on strike when you get to Sedona. But enjoy your trip. In many respects, we owe our nation and many of its founding principles to Thomas Paine. The ideas promoting the dignity of labor laid out in agrarian justice certainly earned Paine a place as an adjacent UU on that poster that's in our lobby out there. I'm going to have to check to see if Frances Perkins made the poster too, because she certainly should be at least an adjacent UU if she wasn't a UU. And I would also consider that George McNeill is an adjacent UU. He wasn't a UU, but Cam is, so that counts, right? Worthy of being on our poster in our lobby, and especially in light of his close personal connection to our fellowship. So we extinguish this chalice. Linda will help with extinguishing the chalice.
Are you ready for me?
I am, but not its light that today represents a commitment
to. It will be its light. If I extinguish it, I'll extinguish its light.
Yeah, but no, because we're going to carry it with us. Because it represents a commitment to democracy, a passion for justice, and an appreciation for the dignity of all labor. And these we will proudly carry with us into tomorrow's Labor Day holiday and every day into the world.
Yes, we will.
You can put the peace lamp.
Well, you didn't
too.
Tell me to yet.
We'll do. We don't have special words for the peace lamp.
Peace be with you.
Peace be with you. All people of the world. All right.
There you go.
Now, our closing song today is going to be We'll Build a Land. And the words are by Barbara Zanotti, and the music is by Carolyn McDade. This is one of my favorite UU hymns. The title and the lyrics echo a quote from Thomas Paine's Common Sense, which was, "We have it in our power to make the world over again." This version has some revised words and an added verse, and it's performed by Mo Mack in concert with John and Cynthia Bowling. The lyrics will appear on the screen, and you're welcome to stand and sing along. Linda's going to do announcements, and then after the service, we're going to have a postlude, and please stay around for the postlude because it's one of my favorite songs, which is 9 to 5 by Dolly Parton.
We'll build a land where we bind up the broken. We'll build a land where the captives go free, where the oil of gladness dissolves all mourning. We'll build a promised land that can be. Come build a land where sisters and brothers, filled with the Spirit, may then create peace, where justice shall roll down like waters, and peace like an ever-flowing stream. We'll build a land where we bring the good tidings to all the afflicted and all those who mourn, and we'll give them garlands instead of ashes. We'll build a land where peace is born. Come build a land where sisters and brothers, filled with the Spirit, may then create peace, where justice shall roll down like waters, and peace like an ever-flowing stream. We'll build a land where the forests are fertile, where the water and wind run clean and clear, and community matters more than possessions. Come share this land, let's build it right here. Come build a land where sisters and brothers, filled with the Spirit, may then create
Vernon.